This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In 2009, on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the opening of the permanent installation of Étant Donné in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the artist Jeff Wall gave a keynote address for a conference at the museum devoted to Duchamp's last work. In his lecture, Wall recounted the tenor of art discourse the year in which Étant Donné was unveiled, 1969. 1969 was also the year Joseph Kossuth's Art After Philosophy and Art and Languages, Art Language were published, representing, for Wall, the most reductive readings of the ready-made and a crystallization of the Duchampian reception as the aesthetic of negation. But if 1969 represented the zenith in this reading of Duchamp, the unveiling of Étant Donné also constituted a regime change, inaugurating already the post-conceptual moment. For Jeff Wall, a significant part of the story lies in how, by keeping Étant Donné a secret, Duchamp figured out how to make a second masterwork, while the ready-made's canonical authority was maintained. In Étant Donné, claimed Wall, the ready-made unconditionally does not appear. To demonstrate this point, he made a list of objects in Étant Donné that cannot be ready-mades. I recall this recent example in the reception of Marcel Duchamp because it is in many ways unremarkable. But while I have no stakes in finding ready-made objects in Étant Donné, the question I would ask is whether one can still think of the ready-made as primarily an object, rather than, for example, a set of relations or propositions. And if that is so, what does Étant Donné teach us about the relational, ready-mades or otherwise? Between 1992, when I first saw Étant Donné and was immediately struck by the experience, in 1996, when I produced a show at Pathearn Gallery in New York addressing what I learned from seeing Étant Donné, I thought about this question a great deal. During the 1990s, when I was a young artist in New York, there were many arguments against venturing yet another reading of Duchamp. The contemporary art discourse of the day was no longer obsessed with the endgames of negation, but proliferations of Duchampians informed by the politics of difference, feminist, queer, and post-colonial, and wading through the excesses of commodity fetishism overpopulated the landscape. My engagement with Duchamp came out of this moment. My thoughts were scattered, speculative, and probably wanting in terms of art historical scholarship. But I made this engagement public because I also felt that Étant Donné gave me something unique, a model for an approach towards seeing and thinking that almost two decades later still remains with me. In 1999, I was asked to give a lecture on Étant Donné for a panel on deconstruction at NYU with Jacques Derrida as my intended respondent. When he became indisposed, Avital Ronell stepped in. And now what follows is my return to this text, which I had let sit for 10 years, reading dust. The viewer draws back from the door feeling that mixture of joy and guilt, of one who has unearthed a secret. But what is the secret? What, in fact, has he seen? There is, so they say, a secret in Philadelphia. I'm, of course, talking about Étant Donné, Marcel Duchamp's last major work that was permanently installed in an unmarked room in the Philadelphia Museum of Art in 1969, nearly a year after he died. Most of us here know the mythic details. We know that Étant Donné was conceived perhaps even before Duchamp began working on its physical form in 1946. We know that he would work on it until or perhaps even after 1966 when he signed it off. We know that it is considered the analog of the definitively unfinished large glass, that its title comes from two of the 93 faithfully reproduced notes from the green box which served as Duchamp's working notes for the large glass. We also know that Duchamp never talked, and that for most of the 20 years that he labored on the work, only his most intimate circle knew of the existence of Étendonné. In other words, we know that it was a kind of secret that he took smiling to his grave. Anyway, it's always the others who die. And for 15 years, the museum in Philadelphia staged it as a secret. If to know anything about a work of art, you first have to know what it looks like, Étendonné was unusually coy, even for Duchamp. The museum placed a prohibition on photographing the diorama behind the door until 1984. Thus, the only images of Étendonné that circulated were pictures of the door. The description of the interior view, at least publicly, floated on words alone. This went, we are told, according to the wishes of the deceased. But if there is something secret here, it would not be, so Jacques Derrida reminds us, a matter of an artistic or technical secret reserved for someone or for several, such as style, ruse, the signature of talent, of the mark of a genius, the know-how that is thought to be incommunicable, untransmittable, unteachable, inimitable. It would not even be a matter of what that psychophysical secret, that art hidden in the depths of the human soul. It is not a deprived interiority that one would have to reveal, confess, announce. There is something secret, but it does not conceal itself. The function of the museum as the apparatus for housing Étendonné teaches us something about the mechanics of secrecy. What is secret and hidden is not so much that it is unseeable as what is not allowed to circulate as the view of the seeable. If the door of Étendonné stood in for the photographable version of this work of art, it is because it functioned as a demonstration of the apparatus and a manifestation of the figure of law, like the gate beyond which Kafka's supplicant before the law cannot transgress. What the photograph stages is what is allowed to be shown. The prohibition does not so much hide what is behind the door, for that is in fact on display, but secures the erotic texture of the door as a phallic veil, a fetishistic substitution. It would be an open secret. Like the difference between a picture of the door of Étendonné and a picture of the view of its interior, the secret folds back onto itself as a delay effect of 15 years. But does the work become less secret once the interior view of Étendonné was allowed to be shown? It's more revealed after one looks through the peepholes and discovers what is kept behind the door. With the publication of the Manual of Instructions for Étendonné, did the secret go away? Or is it still trying to reveal itself? Rosalind Krauss's analysis of Étendonné was written as part of the history of the optical unconscious of the 20th century. It offers us two models of how vision is incarnated. The first applies to the situation of the voyeur. Using a passage from Being and Nothingness, Krauss first grafts Jean-Paul Sartre's body onto the voyeur, Duchamp's turn for the viewer of Étendonné. Sartre describes himself poised at the keyhole, hunched and peering, about to look through, when he is suddenly interrupted by footsteps, which announces that the gaze of someone else has taken him, both by surprise and from behind. Krauss describes a transformation. It is as this pinioned object, this body bent over the keyhole, this carnal being trapped in the searchlight of the other's gaze, that Sartre thickens into an object, and thus an outsider to his own eyes. For in this position, he is no longer pure, transparent intentionality beamed at what is on the door's far side, but rather simply a body caught on this side. He has become a self that exists on the level of all other objects of the world, a self that has suddenly become opaque to its own consciousness, a self that he therefore cannot know but only be, a self that, for that reason, is nothing but a pure reference to the other. And it is a self that is defined by shame. Krauss carefully distinguishes the difference between the Sartrean subject before the door and the Duchampian voyeur by underscoring a crucial difference. For having had sought the peephole of Étant Donné, Duchamp's viewer has in fact entered a kind of optical machine through which it is impossible not to see. She quotes Jean-François Léotard's description of the viewing machine. The device will be specular. The plane of the breach will be that of a picture that will intersect the focal pyramids, having for their summit the viewing points or peepholes. In this type of organization, the viewpoint and vanishing point are symmetrical. Thus, if it is true that the latter is the vulva, it is a specular image of the peeping eyes, such that when they think they're seeing the vulva, they see themselves. Con celui qui voit, he who sees is a cunt. Unlike the Sartrean voyeur poised at the keyhole, caught trying to disavow this body as an object for the other, the voyeur of Étant Donné gets to see, but he is nonetheless caught up in all the shades of embarrassment his consciousness is subjected to when its look is ricocheted back onto the eyes of a carnal body. One whose vision is hooked up to that glandular system that has everything to do with the secretion of sex and fear. Étant Donné is an optical machine hooked up to one's complicity in the realm of public exposure. The fact that the door, as the figure of substitution and of the repressed, also implicitly stands in for the interior obscenity and underscores the point that an erotics of veiling was always at issue. But in oscillating between the exterior door and interior, we often skip over the mechanics of this veiling. I turn our attention to the hole in the wall that frames the illuminated interior. In Duchamp's notes, he refers to it as le manque, meaning breach, defect, failure, and also lack. So I'm talking about, obviously, this hole right here. For Krauss, this is the thick and elegant material viewing point that anchors the physicality of the con just beyond. It is a hole, yes, but it is also a frame that draws the limit of what is shown. Here one is reminded of the indeterminacy of framing Derrida describes as the logic of the paragon. That is, how the very establishment of a system as system, a viewing point, for example, implies a beyond which it violently excludes. But at the same time, the frame sits as a blur between inside and outside. Manque celui qui voit, you might say. The question is not what lies beyond and therefore within the frame, but what's on this side of what's beyond the frame. It is a form which has as its traditional determination not that it stands out, but that it disappears, buries itself, effaces itself, melts away at the moment it deploys its greatest energy. The paragon, according to Derrida, is thick. It has a thickness, a surface which separates it, not only as Kant would have it, from the integral inside, from the body proper of the ergon, but also from the outside. It stands out both from the ergon and from the milieu. It stands out, first of all, like a figure on a ground. But it does not stand out in the same way as the work. The latter also stands out against a ground. But the paragonal frame stands out against two grounds. But with respect to each of these two grounds, it merges into the other. In the case of Étant Donné, this is a literal translation. Just as Sartre's regard at the keyhole thickens into a body, the enframing darkness thickens into a space between the door and the brick wall. The darkness wraps around Le Monde and fills a three-dimensional room that we know exists, but do not see for itself, since it cannot be shown, except as the frame of the interior view of étantonné, the pre-existing condition of vision. At the same time, this blind spot not only renders the edges of visual representability, but also anchors the inside-outside distinction in the description of étantonné that allows us to think the door as its outside and the diorama as the inside. Like its cousin, the glory hole, the structure is both a threshold and a space, an enveloping hole containing within itself the blind darkness of the desire to penetrate. So basically just referring to this space in between. And of course, Duchamp had, by 1920, already rendered darkness visible in a play of positive-negative space. In Fresh Widow, the first work signed and copyrighted by Eros et la Vie, the panes of a miniature window built to Duchamp's specification are covered in squares of black leather. The effect is that one looks through the window into the darkened room, or out the window into the black night. This blackness can be said to be simultaneously empty as air or opaquely material as leather, implying an interior exterior that is either framed by the window or the surrounding darkness on the other side that is both within its bounds and envelops it. The window is not just a viewing device, but also a suturing apparatus, a structure for emplacement. To describe a similar operation in our object at hand, I follow Léotard's notes, but also for other reasons, refer to this center space of étantonné as an antechamber. Wedged as the support of two pictures, the antechamber is rarely discussed by most commentators of étantonné, except occasionally via a description of its function as the inner chambers of a camera obscura. In Duchamp's notes in the Manual for Instructions for étantonné, he gives directions for achieving the desired effect. 1. Line the back of the door with black velvet, leaving just enough space for the voyeur's two peepholes. 2. A black velvet curtain fixed just above the bricks, along the width of the panel for the bricks, rises in a diagonal to the top of the door, making a kind of black sky between bricks and door. 3. Two black velvet curtains hang from top to bottom, one on each side of the framework, between bricks and door, to complete a kind of completely dark camera obscura when looking through the voyeur's peepholes. The antechamber's function, metaphoric or otherwise, bears a strong resemblance to the discourse of the Platonic chora, space, which with no attribute of its own, nevertheless gives form to matter, an enabling place. An impossible middle that is itself self-obliterating and excluded from representation. Chora is that which gives as the threshold to the forms of the world. Both Irigaray and Derrida remind us that insofar as the metaphor of the womb resides in chora, chora's feminine attributes must be acknowledged and honored. As Gatry Spivak says, a mother's debt is never paid, and space is the mother in which we are placed. To call this space an antechamber is to do so in honor of the anteriority of this debt. There is an ethical dimension to this recognition. In thinking the darkness of the antechamber simultaneously as threshold and space, I find that, once again, Duchamp was not only there first, but he wrote it down. In the note titled Avertissement, one of the two notes from the green box that gives Étendonnée its name, he writes, "Nothing, perhaps. Notice. Warning." You can see it over there, but the English translation's over here. "Nothing, perhaps. Notice. Warning. Given, if given, in the dark. One, the waterfall. Two, the illuminating gas in the dark. Given, if given, in the dark. Darkness gives." This is not the first time the Duchampian space is explicitly a threshold. This is what Léotard, in another part of his meditation on Duchamp, refers to as the hinge operation in Duchamp. A hinge in logic would be a paradoxical operator. Monsieur Marcel or Mademoiselle Eros, door of the Rue Larrey, open and or closed. If man, then non-woman. But if man and or woman, what then? The and or hinge appears to affirm the symmetry in the incongruence of the two terms. All the two terms he speaks of, two-term limits, like a door of Étendonnée and the breach to the beyond. Or can the threshold of the hinge teach us something else? That is this a division of male and female, bachelor and bride? Marcel Eros or Marcel? Perhaps the threshold as space teaches us a counterintuitive lesson in thinking hinge beyond the open or closed door. This was also a specific address. It was where Marcel lived. Can the arc of the door's sweep, the in-between threshold, not also echo the paragonal structure as both product and production of the frame, signaling the always already there other within the same? Does the hinge always collapse and then reproduce two terms of difference, closing one door as it opens the other? Can we not instead configure the divide to venture another reading, where we allow for the door a metaphor of the drive and its sweeping, its opening and closing, like the blink of an eye or the grip and release of an orifice, to signal the on-off pulsation of desire? Can the masturbatory production of difference from within, where lack is staged to be overcome in an endless repetition, the sweep of the door within its threshold then would clap encore? There is a pulse to this Duchampian threshold. When the voyeur thickens into carnal embodiment upon the view, his symmetrical double, Le Comte, on the other side, the apparatus that facilitates the mise en abîme of his visual delectation, the black sky that frames the view, the antechamber, is the syntactical picturing of this pulse. Although she does not discuss at any length on the antechamber, my minding of this gap is in some way an extension of Rosalind Krauss's insistence on the desublimation of vision in Duchamp, who proclaims not only an aristocratic disinterest in the selection of ready-mades, but also Eros et la vie. In a discussion that follows a 1987 lecture on the centrality of embodied desire in vision in Duchamp, Krauss contemplates aloud the possibility of using Lacan's desubjectivized gaze to analyze Étendonnée, but concludes that, for historical and heuristic reasons, her reading would remain with the resonance of Sartre's pinioned voyeur. Several years later, Kasia Silverman rereads the Krauss-Léotard literature and reframes Étendonnée as one instance of a threshold of the visible world. Although different from my earlier description of the ethical dimension in the spacing of anteriority, Silverman's mapping of where Le Regard falls on Étang Donné is also presented as an experience toward an ethics of the look. She locates the familiar but important difference in Sartre and Lacan's conception of the look. Lacan desubjectivizes the gaze by stripping it of all the qualitative functions which Sartre attributes to it. For Lacan, the gaze does not judge, create, or dominate. It does not even look in any real sense of the word. Lacan metaphorizes the gaze as a camera so as to characterize it as an apparatus whose only function is to put us in the picture. Lacan insists that the gaze by which the voyeur is surprised not only constitutes him as a spectacle and devises look of its illusory mastery, but reveals to him that he is a subject sustaining himself in a function of desire. Desire within the scopic field, she explains, is necessarily grounded in castration. Lacan's four fundamental concepts thus suggest not just that the look is one of the primary trajectories through which subjectivity is routed, and that it is always libidinally sustained, but also that it is predicated upon lack. The mirror stage fetishism and the belong to me aspect of representation, so reminiscent of property, are models of misrecognition that compensate for this foundational dimension in desire. The staging of the last is, of course, what one associates with the diorama beyond the breach in Étang Donné. Silverman charts the trajectory of vision described by Léotard and Krauss from the equivalence that perspective that is drawn between the eye and le con to the carnal social subject-object who is caught looking, implicated within the public optical spheres. But the Duchamp work, for Silverman, also affects a remarkable deconstruction of the grounding opposition upon which sexual difference is based. The male look at the female genitals is emblematic of that exteriorizing displacement through which the male subject repeatedly situates his lack at the sight of the female body and naturalizes it as essentially, that is, anatomically other. The additional oppositions which the Duchamp diorama works both to articulate and collapse, carnality, transcendence, spectacle, eye, are built upon this foundational antithesis. When the male voyeur, who is caught within the machinery diagrammed by Léotard, a machinery which is itself the product of Duchamp's own transformative act of seeing, finds his look put in a mirror relation to the female genitals, he is given the opportunity to acknowledge as his own what he is accustomed to throw away violently, and so to renegotiate the relation between his ego and the object. So I obviously have a picture of the man and a man and a woman, you know, at the keel, but I thought I would show the woman here to demonstrate something else, which we can discuss later. Silverman suggests that the acknowledgement of momentary disabling upon being seen constitutes the possibility of an ethical deferral, a turning away from the violent delusions of selfhood, which defends against lack through attempts to dominate the other. The ethical becomes operative not at the moment when unconscious desires and phobias assume possession of our look, but in a subsequent moment when we take stock of what we have just seen and attempt with an inevitable limited self-knowledge to look again differently. While Silverman's discussion of Étang Donné stops at around this point, she continues to theorize the possibility of an ethical decentering of the dominant fictions of reality via Lacan's famous example of Holbein's The Ambassadors. Although I can offer only the most cursory rehearsal of the Lacanian interpretation of The Ambassadors, I'm interested in highlighting Silverman's reading so as to bring us closer, finally, to the moment I come near étantonné. In the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis, Lacan equates the conventional perspectival construct with its central vanishing point and parallel privilege viewing point to a Cartesian notion of subjectivity. In occupying such a position, one enacts the fantasy of mastery, a méconnaissance that produces one's fictional sense of import, singularity, and plenitude. But what this painting also lays bare, beyond the depiction of the ambassador's riches and proprietary relationship to the world, is the graphic reminder of such dominion as illusion. The strange diagonal shape in the lower foreground of the painting interrupts the unity of this fantasy, and if seen from a certain angle below, the shape coheres into the image of a skull. In the Lacanian schema, the anamorphic skull is an inversion of the conventional geometrical perspective, literally relocating the viewer away from the all-seeing fantasy, pointing him away from the sovereignty of the viewing subject. The anamorphic skull is not only finitude's check on the hubris of the ego, it puts the subject in the picture, under the gaze, as the subject is annihilated. Silverman sees something more in the death's head, namely, insofar as the geometrical view of the ambassadors address the viewer in a proper mode of pictorial enunciation, it is also a version of the world that can be called a dominant fiction, a system of ordering perception into normative versions of reality. What the anamorphic version gives us, then, is the possibility to challenge the dominant fiction in the shape of a more difficult, but possible, counter-hegemonic view of the world. Perhaps it is an understatement to say that Marcel Duchamp also challenges dominant views of the world. In the field of the aesthetic, can we not say that it was Duchamp who taught us that what we see is not what we see? Duchampian detours would often be the critique of positivistic visual regimes. For example, retinal painting. As he once said in an interview, since the advent of Impressionism, visual production stops at the retina. Impressionism, Fauvism, Cubism, abstraction, it's always a matter of retinal painting. Their physical preoccupations, the reactions of colors, etc., put the reactions of the gray matter in the background. The great merit of surrealism is to have tried to rid itself of retinal satisfaction, of the arrest of the retina. Elsewhere, Duchamp charts the difference between appearance and apparition. The normative perceivable experience he puts on the side of appearance, the visual on the side of appearance, which in the case of an object will be the sum of the usual sensory evidence enabling one to have an ordinary perception of the object. Its apparition, in contrast, is the mold of it. There is the surface apparition, which is like a kind of mirror image looking as if it were used or making of this object, like a mold. But this mold of the form is not itself an object. It is the image in n-1 dimensions of the essential points of this object of n dimensions. The three-dimensional appearance comes from the two-dimensional apparition, which is the mold of it. He refers to shadows and photographic negatives. Sometimes he would speak of the warmth of a seat as apparitional. Sometimes the two-dimensional apparition would skip a dimension and land very close to the fourth. The apparitional, in other words, is what we often think of as Duchamp's challenge to the world of appearance, what we think of as a Duchampian sense of the world. In a similar vein, starting in 1937, Duchamp began to articulate a theory of the infra mens, the infra thin, in a series of notes that would later describe several works that foreshadow the casting operation he employs in Étant donné. I'm thinking of Female Fake Leaf, which is what you see, Objet d'Art, Wedge of Chastity, and With My Tongue in My Cheek. These are all from 1950 to 1959. As fitting for the spirit of the term, there is no coherent definition of the infra thin. Described in comments or scraps of notes across several decades, the infra thin points to almost imperceptible liminal forms of differences, both physical and mental. Traces that do not exist as things in their own right, but as in-between states, as potential, or as chance. Often, the infra thin is expressed metonymically, via puns, or libidinally, via bodily shape, sound, temperature, or touch. When pressed on the question of the erotic, Duchamp replied, "Without using those words, this is an old idea of mine, a pet idea explained by the fact that a tactile sensation wrapping all the size of an object approximates a fourth dimension. Fourth dimensional tactile sensation, for of course none of our senses has a four-dimensional application except perhaps the sense of touch. Thus the love act, as tactile sublimation, might give us a tiny glimpse, or rather a tiny touch, of a physical interpretation of the fourth dimension." But lest the infra-thin be confined in the phenomenological arena, Duchamp also insisted that allegory in general is an application of the infra-thin. Described as such, the infra-thin would seem to be a linguistic as well as an experiential membrane, connecting at once the signifier and signified, the form, idea, and feeling of the sign. At least once he applied the infra-thin to artistic reception. Described as the exchange between what one puts on view and the glacial regard of the public, which sees and forgets immediately. The time difference between the artist and the receiver, Duchamp locates in the infra thin, is also referred to as a delay, which is both temporally measurable and potentially grounded in the social. Although not often explored, this also describes the mechanics of the ready-made. And this is just a quote from the specification for ready-mades in the green box. "By planning for a moment to come, on such a day, such a date, such a minute, to inscribe a ready-made, the ready-made can later be looked for with all kinds of delays. The important thing, then, is just this matter of timing, this snapshot effect. Like a speech delivered on no matter what occasion, but at such and such an hour, it is a kind of rendezvous." Seen in this light, this snapshot, if you will, this rendezvous with the ready-made will find its meeting place inching away from the conventional story of the mass-produced commodity objects relocated to the aesthetic realm and toward other encounters, other relations. So what I'm going to do is just show you various installations of Fountain without reading all of this. As you know, Fountain was submitted for the Armory Show in 1917, but it was rejected and never shown, and this is the photographic record of it. But the original object was lost. On the far right over here, you see an installation from 1950. This is when Sidney Janis found a urinal in a Paris flea market, and he exhibited with Duchamp's approval. And unlike the more famous orientation of fountain, this one is installed upright, and in right side up, that is, and in Duchamp's words, so that little boys can use it. So when it was shown again in 1953, he suspended it over a doorway and put mistletoe below it. It's a sort of prelude to a kiss. So after making unauthorized versions of two ready-mades, Ove Linda worked with Duchamp to remake Fountain by purchasing a urinal from the men's room of a Stockholm restaurant. And of course, when Arturo Schwartz approached Duchamp to issue an edition of the ready-made, the ready-mades were made from scratch. And this is an etching that Duchamp made that year, 1964. So it says, robinet means faucet, but it's also kind of like cock. An original revolutionary robinet, miracle return. A robinet that's stops leaking when no one is listening to it. I can go on and on about Fountain, but I won't. but I just want to make this note, and maybe we can pick it up later, and David can certainly pick it up. And that is that, of course, you know, when Duchamp first talked about the ready-mades, he talked about it as choosing something with disinterest. I just want to note that in 1914, he wrote a note that's been collected in the box, that meaning 3 years before Fountain. And it says, one only has for female the public urinal, and one lives by it. So I'll repeat it again. One only has for female the public urinal, and one lives by it. So this is the second part of the encounter. But I should perhaps start telling you what I see when I look at Étrange Donnée. Since the first time I encountered the piece to now, from talking to others who've made the pilgrimage to Philadelphia, and from reading descriptions written on the work, I cannot say that what I saw was unique. But if you recall the lessons we learned from Lacan and Lacombe, what is from carnal, that is, from carnal embodiment of the voyeur's share and the anamorphic arrest of the subject under the gaze, you will see that I have inverted the question. It is not so much what I see in Étrange Donnée, but how Étrange Donnée sees and had, even before I encountered it, already seen me. In my first journey to Philadelphia, which meant my first pilgrimage, if you will, to the Philadelphia Museum, what I first encountered when I entered the darkened room was not the ambassadors, but the skull. Duchamp had indeed put me in an apparatus through which it is impossible not to see. But what I see before and after Lacan is this. This was my sardine can moment. Everybody gets one, Mine just happens to be on a Duchamp. I am a picture. This is the function that is found at the heart of the institution of the subject in the visible. What determines me at the most profound level in the visible is the gaze that is outside. It is through the gaze that I enter light, and it is from the gaze that I receive its effects. Hence it comes about that the gaze is the instrument through which light is embodied, and through which, if you will allow me to use a word, as I often do, in a fragmented form, I am photographed. That's a quote from Lacan. In the Lacanian gaze, if the Lacanian gaze and Étant donné share a metaphor in that both are compared to the camera, then these cameras seem to photograph only one subject, the one who thinks he sees. Duchamp was right. There is a snapshot effect to this rendezvous. But as I made clear earlier, I am not the only one who sees this snapshot. I am merely one pricked by it. With the opening of this punctum, I will inaugurate the word I have thus far withheld, but in doing so, perhaps I am only catching up to you. The word is face. It is not a mystery how this face came to be, for we know that the countless viewers of Étant donné, with the oils on their faces, the sweat on their brows, their breath, their endless approaches, have marked on the door of Étant donné a defacing face propelled by a drive to see, a desire that does not begin or end with my desire, but through it. I am located and indexed in the museum. So just by way of comparison, I'm showing you the first photograph that depicts Étant donné with the nail still in the door, and a subsequent photograph. To quote, the exchange between what one puts on view and the glacial regard of the public. Or are we looking at another slice of the unforthin? The possible is an unforthin. The possibility of several tubes of color becoming a surah is the concrete explanation of the possible as unforthin. That's another quote from Duchamp on unforthin. If I find the unforthin in this face, it is because it lies on the cusp of the author function and a conservation problem. The very recognition of either or both reorient our sense of what is proper and paragonal to the work of art. The face as a manifestation of the collaboration between the art institution of the museum and the art institution that is in us. In this sense, unforthin of the face is not exterior to the viewer, but a kind of infrastructure. And if so, can this unforthin of the possible not only be the difference between two mass-produced objects from the same mold, or a visible unforthin? Those are also those quotes are also what Duchamp says about the unforthin. Is this, in other words, also a painting? Like a painting, what one sees is an illusion created literally through touch, like the fall of rain from the painter's brush, as Merleau-Ponty would say, that coheres on the surface on the door like a phenomenological trompe-l'oeil. Is not the continual coming near of the museum goer, who each, one at a time, propelled toward a desire to see, mapping their eyes upon what we imagine Duchamp saw, upon what we imagine Duchamp wants us to see, in the alignment of what we imagine to be seeing a Duchamp. Are we not structurally each equivalent to a stroke, each contributing to an image that I am proposing sees us? Should not the question be brought closer to what Lacan called the reign of the brush? If a bird were to paint, would it not be by letting fall its feathers, a snake by casting off its scales, a tree by letting fall its leaves? In each viewer leaving a slice of their unforthin material human stain, their literal bodily excretion upon the door of a Duchamp, borrowing eyes to see the body of another whose denuded sex and illuminating gas shine a light back onto our self-consciousness, do we not, like Duchamp, also complete a wayward landscape with nothing more than excretions divested from our bodies? For this, too, is a Duchampian method. For all the talk of bodily fluids of which Duchamp was so fond, the, quote, pigment that paints Paysage Votif, the wayward landscape of 1946, dedicated to Maria Martens, was determined by conservators to be human semen, presumably Marcel's own. This is Duchamp painting after Duchamp stopped painting. And if this too is Duchamp painting, what, or more precisely, who can be said to be the ready-made? Let us consider, Duchamp tells us, the two poles of the creation of art. The artist on the one hand, and on the other, the spectator who later becomes the posterity. To all appearances, the artist acts like a mediumistic being who from the labyrinth beyond time and space seeks his way out to a clearing. To encounter this face is to see the otherness in oneself in a mirarical return. Like the Duchamp who saw Eros et la vie in the accumulation of dust, the coherence of a picture that is composed over time by the blind compulsion of the unmotivated sign. The dust that became dust breeding did so in the same manner that the traces of the viewers of Étant Donné stained its door to become a face through the sheer indexical concentration of matter in situ, directed by nothing more than entropic gravity and human bodies coming near in their drive to see. This is the domain of Eros et la vie, Duchamp noted in the caption when this image appeared in 1922. How arid it is, how fertile, how joyous, how sad. If dust were catechistically given the fecund life quality of breeding by Duchamp, what would he have seen around the voyeur's peepholes on the door of Étant Donné? That we cannot know. There is work to be done in thinking the ethical dimensions of preserving vision under the sign of the indexical. What we do know is that upon learning the large glass which had occupied him for 8 years was smashed into bits while in transit in 1927, Duchamp welcomed the destruction as a rendezvous with chance. And 9 years later, spent some months mending the work, carefully and patiently putting every piece back together. This is familiar Duchampian lore, but it is also the Duchampian ethos. We also know that the preservation of this reminder of vulnerability did not end here. When Duchamp collected and produced and reproduced his works in the Bois en Valise, he faithfully reproduced the cracks. Duchamp did not only function as the curator, caretaker of his work, but also what happened to his work. Looking at the door of Étantonnet, I am reminded of the Duchamp who displayed profound respect for otherness in the register of the indexical, who indeed developed a methodological guideline to preserve both slow, sedimental accumulations and shattering chance encounters. This Duchamp genealogy will not produce sons to engage in Oedipal brawls in the halls of art history in order to establish rightful lineage. Rather, this is the Duchamp who allows the signification of the other to be, who honors difference, who, with minimal disturbance to the integrity of the indexical sign, preserves otherness, be it born in the void of the cora, felt tenuously as the unforthin, or comes to one as is a ready-made. When I first wrote this paper more than a decade ago, the title was Duchamp with Levinas. I was setting up a blind date. Both had been dead for some time, but as we know, it's always the others who die. If I locate an ethics on the Duchampian door that is given, it is because I have learned from Emmanuel Levinas to acknowledge the face that I see. This is a quote from Levinas. A face is a trace lost in a trace, less than nothing in the trace of an excessive but always with ambiguity, trace of itself, possibly a mask in a void, possibly nothingness of pure form of the sensibility. The face of the neighbor obsesses me with this destitution. He is looking at me. Everything in him looks at me. Nothing is indifferent to me. Nothing is more imperative than this abandon in the void of space, this trace of the infinity that passes without being able to enter. In it is hollowed out the face as a trace of absence, as a skin with wrinkles. I see a face made up of the endless approaches toward its colorless, endlessly bright holes, holes which burn into me the recognition that simply I see a face. But why am I approaching? Am I not approaching a face? What is approaching after one recognizes the face? I do not claim, nor do I think, that this face on the door of Étantonnet is the same as the face in Levinas. For Levinas, the face is the figure of the other, the pure ethical relation. The epiphany of the face is ethical, and is neither phenomenological, what appears, nor something one can turn toward with knowledge and perception. The relation with the face can surely be dominated by perception, but what is specifically the face is what cannot be reduced to that. In the figure of the face, we measure our temptation for violence as well as our responsibility to care. It is sometimes better, he says, when seeing the face of the other, to not even notice the eye, to not even notice the color of his eyes. But if it was from the contour of Levinas' ethics that I began to think the face on Étantonnet, it is because these eyes also have no color, because here is no face in particular, because the face-to-face here is also explicitly for me an ethical relation. I do not know if we can choose to see faces, but we can deny seeing them. What did Duchamp see? He who thought so deeply and patiently through the untimeliness of posterity. How does the author function help us now? What I cannot be sure of is that Duchamp did not already see this coming. And if that is so, then this face is not just on the door of Étant Donné, but is anterior to Étant Donné. It is a face which, like the antechamber, stands before and behind that which is given. It is a face which preserves the one coming near, the nearness of the one who is near. It is the face of the neighbor. The Duchamp I read with Levinas is not only the Duchamp who honors difference in his thinking of art objects, but also the one who most strongly and openly affirms an ethical aesthetics of otherness within an economy of art production that is as articulate a form of esthesis as any I know. What is called for is a rethinking of what we call the Duchampian. What does it mean to affirm this face in the face of art, authorship, knowledge, power? The apparitional face is the figure of what Duchamp calls a delay. It is the viewer who completes the picture. This belatedness is also at the core of Levinas' ethics. It is the other who has always already arrived. In approaching the other, writes Levinas, I am always late for the rendezvous. If repetition has a face, it is always the others who die. If finitude has a face, or maybe you don't see anything. There is, so they say, a secret in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Simon and I have had a long conversation about Duchamp, as well as other issues regarding art and ethics. So it's nice to be able to respond to him in public and also in a more formal way. So I'm going to make a few remarks, and then I think we're going to just talk or answer questions. And also, I apologize, I have a cough. You've probably heard this already from the side of the room where I was sitting, so hopefully I won't start hacking in the middle. I want to focus on the two motifs or issues that I think Simon brings out in a very original way, the face and the anteroom, and say a number of things about each of those. I think what's very interesting and what he doesn't really focus on in his talk is how the face in this work is actually obliterated in, I would say, a kind of triple way. First, what's interesting is that the face made by the traces of other faces at the eye holes is invisible when you're actually making it, because, of course, your face is pressed against it. So there's a kind of, well, not to be too much of a cute Duchampian, but there's a kind of mirrorical return in the pressing of the face to the face that I think is very interesting. But it also renders it invisible. And of course, there are two other invisibilities of the face, one which I think is almost unconscious. The obvious one is that the model herself is without a face. So there's a kind of facelessness there. But I would argue, and I never really thought about this except under the impulse to respond to Simon's formal remarks, is that I would almost argue that this hole, this lack, this gap, is itself a kind of surrogate face, that it is shaped almost like a head, and it creates a viewing template that one could think of as a kind of contour of the face. Now, here is where I very much don't agree with the Krauss-Lyotard argument about the vanishing point being the genital area here. First, there's the issue of this genital being strangely not a gap, or it's, people try hard to think of a term that can describe it. Some have called it a tear, et cetera, et cetera. But what I think is interesting is that, in fact, you don't, it doesn't allow you to create a kind of vanishing point, at least in my view. And there are two points here which, if you'll kind of humor my association of the gap in the wall as a kind of face, the lamp and the waterfall, which I assume all of you have seen this work in person, but because this is very badly represented in slides, especially the waterfall, but the lamp being held up is a kind of image of the gaze, certainly, right? Because the gaze is that which makes vision possible. It's not our own agency of vision, but rather the apparatus of vision that makes us visible and makes us it possible for us to see. The lamp is actually in the position of an eye. I mean, how much would I press this? Probably not that much, but I'm not sure it's not worth pressing either. And of course, the waterfall, which we can't see at all in the slide because it's a single image, has a kind of pulsating quality, which is very close to Rosalind Krauss's, I think, very persuasive argument of a kind of visual pulsion in Duchamp's film work. So one, I actually think that what happens here is that the anteroom, in fact, becomes what one sees through instead of seeing into. And this is the distinction that I'd like to make. And I feel like it actually, in my view, or this is in my words, the kind of radicality of what Simon's saying is that the vanishing point is something that you see into, but the anteroom is something that you see through. It's a blind spot. You almost don't notice it. It's, I mean, one could say it's ideology. It's the unconscious, and it's a kind of template too, because it's a big hole. You've got the little holes here and then the big hole. And in favor of this argument, I would just suggest that, in fact, these figures of the gaze that are held by the figure do suggest something of an anti-vanishing point, because the vanishing point then would be the person looking. Right? Because if the gaze is that which creates vision, then the person at the hole is in fact the vanishing point as well. This is part of the Lyotard Krauss reading as well. But I would argue that that in fact everything counters a sort of vanishing point in this work, and in fact what vanishes, what has been invisible, is this anteroom that Simon brings to our to our attention, I think, in a really important way. This is the whole, this is the template, and in a way, I think it's also the face. There's also, I would argue, if you buy or will entertain this distinction between seeing through and seeing into, that there is a kind of historical or temporal dimension to this in Duchamp's work as well. Simon brought up the question of the delay, which is obviously a very important concept for Duchamp. But I think one of the interesting things about the étantonné is that it changes the valence of how we understand delay. Usually delay, as in, you know, when someone's late for a lunch appointment or something like that, a delay tends to have a sort of negative valence. It's late, it's belated. But a delay is also a kind of speculation on time, right? Duchamp did not merely delay. Emergence of the étantonné into a public life, but he suppressed it in speculating on its future. And this he did throughout his career in extremely effective ways through his management of the Ahrensburg collection and his keeping together his work both in Philadelphia and New York, through his work with Catherine Dreyer, both managing his own work and that of his close associates. There's the issue of the famous Brancusi auction that he did in order to help him. It was the Picabia auction and Brancusi. He worked with to kind of disseminate the works and throughout a certain period of time. So I think what this work demonstrates is the futurity of Duchamp's thinking about works of art. It's a delay, but it's a delay that presupposes a future life that somehow is speculative as well. Not only theoretically speculative, but financially speculative, and speculative in terms of reputation. Because I think that Duchamp was quite a brilliant artist in terms of his speculation on his own reputation and the meaning of his work, and that the patience he had, in a way, was the index of his confidence, which came from where, I'm not quite sure. Maybe he knew he was a great genius and never worried about it, but somehow he was able to have the kind of patience that Simon talked about in putting together the glass and allowing things to develop that made possible a kind of speculation on a future that, as we know, is spectacular. I mean, he more or less, I think it's widely agreed that he eclipses Picasso as the great artist of the 20th century during the latter part of the century. And this for an artist who alleged, you know, laziness, slowness, lack of production, always giving up his work, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that there was anything really left to chance in this. And I don't mean this in a pejorative way at all. I think it's one of his great affirmative accomplishments. Now, seeing through is obviously something that one does with glass. And I think that that the large glass and the other works on glass were meant to be transparent in a certain kind of way, whereas the Étant Donné gives us the feeling of seeing through without transparency. What exactly does that mean? I don't know. I mean, maybe we can talk about that. But I think it's significant and interesting. It's often remarked upon, and I think it's undeniable that this work is in some ways closely linked to the glass in every possible way. And so perhaps it's an answer about seeing through that's encapsulated as opposed to transparent. So just the last thing I wanted to say before Simon and I discuss together or we take your questions for a little while is that I was interested in a kind of subtext throughout Simon's talk that had to do with a sort of expanded field of the ready-made, let's say, as a kind of set of relations, I think he says at one point. And I wanted to just suggest a kind of genealogy between the ready-made, the glass, and the Étant Donné in terms of what I've been trying to think of lately as a kind of narrative of things, how things themselves create a kind of narrative that isn't mimetic or figurative, it isn't even really human, but rather has to do, I mean, Simon gave the great example of the fountain, how fountain went through a variety of different relocations. That's what I mean by a kind of narrative of things, or what Arjun Upadhyay has very influentially called a social life of things. So let me just propose these three steps in Duchamp's career, and then maybe we'll sit down together for some conversation. The first would be, I would argue, that the ready-made is a kind of locative narrative, that its meaning has to do with where it's positioned. And again, I think that Simon beautifully demonstrated that in showing how Fountain moved. I mean, for a work that was instantly lost, it got around quite a lot, really. And again, Duchamp's hand, I think, as it were, was certainly gently behind that. The Glass, on the other hand, is a diagrammatic work, which really, one of the things that interests me, and this is, I have a slight, I forgot exactly how you talked about Fresh Widow, but for me, one of the things that I would think about Fresh Widow and the other windows that are opaque as a kind of difference that's encapsulated and put into the world. So it's almost, it's like a connection with nothing it's connected to. It's just pure link. And I think that the Glass wants to create a set of movements across its iconography, which is relatively unknowable unless you know the notes, obviously. And I would call that a kind of diagrammatic movement, which you could link closely to the ready-made's locative movement if you thought about it as a kind of diagram for how an object might move in the world, imaginatively or philosophically. And then I think the Étant Donné is very much involved with a kind of wrapping and encapsulation, which I suppose is pretty obvious, but one of the things that I really loved about Michael's show of the Étant Donné was when you could, I mean, I have to say that I thought one of the most memorable things was the skin, the kind of shed skin of the model or the mannequin, however, whatever word we're supposed to use correctly, the way he tested these different kinds of materials, and then they were there in the exhibition. And I do think that this quality of wrapping and accretion and the dust breeding and all of this is a kind of, and really so movingly, all those amazing photographs Simon had of the face, of the oils of people's face. And I'm sure that you've all had this experience of smelling. I mean, ice, it's smelly too. I mean, it's hard to avoid the fact that there others have been there. I mean, it's pretty clear. That I think that that this is a model instead of a wrapping and encapsulation, as opposed to either a diagrammatic or a locative one. And do I have a good explanation for why? No, not really. But I'm not sure that's necessary anyway. So I think I'll stop there.